Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts. It's an absolute pleasure to see you all here today. If you've not met me before, my name is Sophie. I look after the marketing, events, and membership here at the SMSA. We are proudly one of Sydney's oldest cultural institutions, and we've been keeping Sydney curious for the last 192 years. So today we're joined by our president, Winston Allen, and we were going to have another board member here, Steve, but he's unfortunately not well. So I'm delighted to see so many familiar faces. The members truly are the beating heart of the SMSA. To our first-time visitors, a very, very warm welcome. I do have to say this. If it's your first time here, do pop upstairs after the talk. We've got a gorgeous library on level 2, and we've got the Tom Keneally Centre up on level 3, and they're both gems, and they're just two of the many reasons you should consider becoming a member. That was a theatrical wink for those who missed it. A little shout out to Jade from Simon & Schuster as well. Thanks for coming along today. It's good to see you. So before we start today's conversation, I would like to begin by acknowledging the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, who are the traditional custodians of this land. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and honour their enduring stories, which have been carried through wind and songline. They've been etched into the land and passed from generation to generation. And there's something so beautiful and cyclical about gathering here today to share stories, because for over 60,000 years, this has been a place of storytelling. So may today's discussion do what all good stories should and leave us all a little more curious. Some light housekeeping before I hand over to Matt and Michael. Phones. If your phones are on, please switch them to silent or turn them off altogether, because trust me, if it goes off mid-talk, the judgment in this room is swift and silent. It happened yesterday, actually. The toilets are just outside the doors and to your right. Our friends from Abby's bookstore will be setting up in the foyer a little bit later, and they're running a very, very lucrative deal today. If you buy 3 books, you will get 3 books. So it's wild, I know, but please do support Matt. He's been on tour for nearly a fortnight and he could use the boost. There'll be a Q&A session after the talk. The format here is if you could please raise your hand and I'll dash over to you with the microphone. Right, so the introduction. While I was preparing this introduction, I did a little bit of light internet stalking. Two things stood out. And I'm not going to elaborate on the first one, but first of all, Matt strikes me as the sort of the method actor of the writing world. The second being that he writes like a man being chased, or more specifically, like a man running out of time. And now here is where I'm going to shine a light on the strange synaptic wiring in my brain, because when I wrote that, I was struck down by a very vicious earworm, which was then followed by a bit of echolalia. So I found myself humming the Hamilton number, if you're familiar with that musical. It's that one where they're chasing Alexander all over the stage, chanting, "How does he write like he's running out of time?" And this very nearly led me to doing this as a rap introduction, and I, hand on heart, I wrote it. So there's a very real danger of this descending into a full Lin-Manuel Miranda moment, but sanity prevailed, and you've all been spared the rap, just. But back to Matt. His literary pace is frankly impressive, and it's also a little terrifying. And I, from what I've read from my not stalkerish research, was he starts his day with a casual 10K run before knocking out 2,000 words before lunch.
Not anymore.
Much lazier. Sanity has prevailed. He's written almost 40 books. 40. No safety net, no publisher, just sheer bloody-minded focus. In his spare time, I heard, and this may also be an artifact, but would transcribe novels by hand, which I think is really cool.
Not by hand, but that's a big part of my work day, and I'll get into it with Brisso. But I wish I did it by hand. That would be a lot more authentic.
Both are good. So the latest book, The Forsaken, has been snapped up by Simon and Schuster, and it has one of the most treacherous traits of a book, which is it's utterly unputdownable. So, Matt, I do hold you personally responsible for keeping me up till 4 a.m. when I got the advanced copy, so all your fault. And today, playing the role of interviewer and literary interrogator is Michael Crittenden. His hat has many feathers, including award-winning journalist. He's been to war zones, political trenches, and faced every kind of deadline. And he's the author of The List, Dead Letters, and Smoke, and has a new book coming out in 6 weeks called The Dust. And I had to slip that in there somewhere. So, and Michael is also the master of the perfectly pointed question. And so what happens when you combine Matt's relentless creativity with Michael's razor-sharp insight? We're about to find out, so please join me in giving a warm welcome to Matt and Michael.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much for coming. It is actually quite humbling being here with Matt because... you know, as we've heard, he's written nearly 40 books, or probably more than 40 books by now. And I think I had tried to write a book at his age, and didn't have much success. Finished a book a bit later than that, sent it off to various agents and whatever, and I got back. It's not really for us, but we really liked this one line. You know, which was enough to keep me going. But you know, here he is, self-published, million seller. Before he's even 30, so it is quite humbling, as I say. And I am old enough to be Matt's father, which is part of a joke that we have, because when Matt first came to the Bad Crime Writers Festival here in Sydney last year, which was his first real entree into the world of crime writing, a joke went round. We had a very big table, and a joke went round the table, started by, I think, Candace Fox or Hayley Scrivener. I can't remember that Matt was actually...
Candace started it, yeah.
Yeah, Matt was actually my son, and everybody believed it.
So Candace, I don't know if anyone's read Candace Fox books in here. So I met you, Michael, and Candace on this one night at Bad Crime and got along really well, and almost too well, because Candace then thought, all right, I'm going to play a joke on everyone. And so she said, oh, this is Matt Brissenden. He's only here because of nepotism. And
yeah. I'm happy to say that Matt's real father is here, Brett. So I get off now. I can.
Yeah. So I had to
thank you very much.
I had to go around the festival, saying that trust me, please, it's not nepotism. I'm not related to Brisso. But yeah, it was very surreal, and I was incredibly grateful for everyone who was that welcoming.
Yeah, well, it's great, and it's also fantastic to see. Someone young come into this, someone so young come into this with so much behind them, and this is the new generation of what we do, and it's brilliant. It's great to see, and it's such a great thing that this book has had so much support and is going to be so successful. So let's get to the book.
Mm-hmm.
For 10 years, Logan Booth served as a contract killer for the CIA.
Yep.
He just didn't know it. In the twilight of his career, Logan learns that he's been a vessel for furthering government interests, not a rogue hitman for a band of vigilantes. He's driven by his own moral code, which is basically forged by his love of some of the classic philosophers, and he has an ally, which is a younger woman called Alice Mason, who is a homeless witness with a target on her back. The book has been described as relentless, as cinematic. Matt's been described as a bright new talent shaking up the genre. And I have to say, if you're into these sorts of things, which is these sort of relentless thriller moments, this is a terrific example of that, but it goes deeper. It has much more depth than you would imagine. The characters are really well formed, and the writing is beautiful. Logan, the hero, studied journalism and then became a contract killer. Go figure.
Okay. So that was deliberately designed just to get your endorsement quote. No, it wasn't. So, yeah, there was something I wanted to do with this book, which was flipping a couple of the cliches of the genre on its head, because So I grew up reading the Jack Reacher thrillers, the Vince Flynn series, American Assassin, and all of these kind of vigilante justice thrillers. And I think I wanted to do something where, you know, usually it's those assassins or those contract killers or government agents who are sort of like they're serving their nation. And I wanted to almost go in the complete opposite direction, where we have this character who is inspired by these much older American philosophers like Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson, who are kind of like the early transcendentalists. And I wanted to write, I guess, a more philosophical thriller from the beginning. I studied philosophy in high school. It's something I've always been drawn to. And I think it can work very well with thrillers, because thrillers are often books that deal with the most extreme circumstances. You know, it's people who are, if it's a Jack Reacher novel, there's violence all the way throughout. There's definitely a lot of violence in this one. But I wanted that to serve a purpose. I don't want that to just be mindless. I think that it can be very gratuitous to just have violence in there for no reason. And I think that if you have these kind of deeper reasons behind why everyone in the book does what they do, including the villains, which I think that played a big role in my original idea for this book, was to have a very different villain who he's a real estate billionaire. He's bought a lot of politics in New York, and he has crippling social anxiety all the way through the book. So you would think that this would be, you know, not a powerful, menacing villain. But I love the shows and the movies and the books that kind of dissect how monsters got the way they are. So how these people who do terrible things, what series of decisions led up to that, where they see themselves as the hero. Because I one of my favorite quotes is, you know, that every villain is the hero of their own story.
Why don't you just give us a quick elevator pitch, Pracy, of the book?
Yeah, should have started with that. That's, you
know, people probably need to know where we're going.
Elevator pitch is that, so Logan Booth, he's this sort of very principled philosophical contract killer, and he, which you wouldn't think goes hand in hand, but if you read the book, trust me, I do justify it somehow. And so basically he believes that he's a vigilante, and he believes that he's cleaning up after America, because he's willing to be an assassin, but he doesn't really want to serve his country, because he thinks that there's a lot of corruption, and he thinks he wants to clean up after, you know, to handle the business that the American government isn't willing to deal with. And then at the very end of his career, he finds out that he was just being manipulated by the CIA the entire time, and that all he was ever doing was just serving government interests. So the book, I wanted to open the book with that. So that's not the story. That's just why he's in such a terrible place when the book opens. And so he's living in New York. He's living in one of the worst parts of New York. And he's spiraling into a deep depression. And then his best friend, Jorge Romero, is working for the New York Times and is killed because of a piece that he's working on. And that's what kind of brings Logan back out of this slump, even if it's just temporarily. And it gives him this kind of motivation to go on this revenge thriller plot. And then along the way he meets Alice Mason, who is a young woman living on the streets of Brooklyn in New York. And it's a platonic relationship. I didn't want it to be a romance. And it's the core of the book is basically Logan and Alice not knowing what's best for themselves, but knowing exactly how to help each other. And they kind of pull themselves both out of the abyss. Alice is suffering from addiction, and Logan is spiraling into this despair because of what his career was. I wanted two characters who were broken in very different ways and able to help each other, pull themselves out of the abyss that they start in at the beginning of this book. Because I think that ultimately leads to like the most hopeful messaging, I find.
There's a lot of dark in it, but it's not all dark. In the dark, it's easier to see the light. That's not Thoreau, that's me. You can use that anytime you like. At one point, Logan says countries are really just giant, just like giant corporations, obsessed only with their own valuation at the cost of whatever it is they pretend to represent. It gives you a hint at the sort of the rabbit holes of philosophy that he goes down.
Yeah.
But that's the character. But the character comes from you. Why did you take him down that path? What's your own connection to philosophy?
Yeah, well, I think this is also something important to justify. Like, I don't think, I don't think as extremely as Logan does. I don't, you know, I think that there is tremendous benefit to nations and to countries and to, you know. Logan, he follows this philosophy down to its natural sort of conclusion. So Henry David Thoreau, I don't know if anyone's heard of him in the 1800s. He was a very famous philosopher, not back then, but now. He was against slavery from the get-go when that was almost unheard of. And he wrote an essay called Thoreau wrote an essay called Civil Disobedience, which was about if you feel a law is unjust, by weighing it up philosophically, if you come to the conclusion that it's unjust, you can break that law. So that's what leads him to becoming a contract killer, because he thinks that, all right, there's people who are thriving off the suffering of others and they need to be taken out. And so that's not my conclusion. I always need to preface that, but that's Logan's conclusion. And also in this book, I wanted to have a few rebuttals against that. So throughout the book, his handler, you know, there's a point where I don't want to spoil too much, but his handler says, you know, if I sat here long enough with you, I could convince you that you had a net positive impact on the world. I understand that you hate yourself, but yeah. So I didn't just want him to be, I never want the main character to just be preaching about what's right. I don't think anyone ever really enjoys that, and unless it's sort of got some nuance to it. But yeah, so he's very principled, and he thinks that he's basically sorted out in his head what he needs to do for the rest of his life. And so he's committed himself to these specific actions. So that's why he's so broken at the start of this, because he finds that he was philosophically, he was doing the opposite of what he thought he was doing. And whether that's a good or bad thing is not, you know, that's not something I'm making like an objective judgment on. But I think that's what leads to, I think, the most interesting characters. Like, I really wanted to do something different with like a conventional assassin thriller. I think by this point we've read so many of them that a different spin and maybe even a darker spin sometimes can stick with you and can talk about it for a long time after you've read it, hopefully.
And when we first meet Logan at the beginning of this book, he is broken. Like, he is a broken guy, because he's come to this realization that he's been used in such a way. But he meets this younger woman, Alice, who is also broken in a different way, but their relationship becomes the central beating heart of this book. And it is very, very complex, and you've also managed to flip that on its head, because she is, in fact, I mean, he is physically strong, but she is mentally strong. And I think she helps him more than you might imagine to start with.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I wanted to do with this book, because I think, especially when it comes to kind of Hollywood, you either have the damsel in distress, which I don't like, or the, you know, all-powerful strong woman character, and there's nothing in the middle. And I really wanted Alice to be mentally, emotionally, spiritually stronger than this contract killer assassin character. And that was kind of the foundation of this book. Alice, the character, if you dive in and read it, is kind of the core of this book. I wanted to just basically create these two characters at the start, because I sort of visualize everything cinematically in my head, and then drop them into the plot, and then whatever conversations they have, that's what results. I just kind of, I sit down at the computer and I open it up and I have rough plot points of, you know, they need to be at this point by the end of this scene, but what they talk about and their sort of unique characteristics, that is just this, I don't really know how to describe it. It's kind of this like flow state that I get into where I, and you know, they both say occasionally insensitive things, and that, you know, they don't act perfectly in each moment. They're quite mean to each other, but they're bonded through that. And I think that that makes, I hope that makes this book real. And I think that sometimes that can be what's missing from fiction, is like authors sometimes, I've gone through this, I've held back on going too intense or serious with like how many insults people would actually hurl at each other if they're in this really difficult, you know, soul testing situation. And so that, you know, they're yelling at each other for half the book, but they form this unbreakable bond, that, yeah, I think is that that can make the, sometimes make the most powerful stories.
And the other interesting relationships, I mean, there are a lot of interesting relationships in this book, but Logan's relationship with his handlers is also fascinating. And the fact that the CIA duped him, I mean, really? Come on. That wouldn't happen, would it?
No, I'm sure it's never happened ever. So Logan's handler, who we meet at in the first chapter of this book. So basically, this is the man who was sending him on missions for his whole career, and who was saying, you know, I work for this vigilante organization. This person has been, we've determined that they need to die. They're taking advantage of people in horrific ways. Go and do that. And so his code name is Thoreau, after the philosopher. And the book opens with that. Logan's known him as Thoreau for 10 years. And in the prologue of this book, it's not a spoiler because it's the prologue, but Thoreau hands Logan a Hessian sack and says, put this over your head. You're going to hate me for as long as you live, but I need to tell you something. And it's, you're not going to like it, but it's either this or we kill you. So, you know, get in the car, basically. And so Logan gets in the car, and then he's taken underground, and he finds out that he was just a CIA asset the entire time. And so Thoreau's real name is James Moss. And I don't want to spoil too much. I think I can say he turns back up. He turns back up at some point for some reason, which I won't get into. But yeah, it provided this really interesting arena where Logan then gets to meet James for the first time, even though he's worked with Thoreau for 10 years. Thoreau has been his handler. But James is kind of the human underneath all of that. And James knew what he was doing. He was working for the CIA the whole time. He knew he was manipulating Logan. I think that can sometimes, I love writing those scenes because, just having characters like that who can just be earnest and just wear their heart on their sleeve and just completely open up to each other. I think thriller scenarios that are very extreme, like these are, you know, it's a very action-packed, dark book. That can sometimes lead to these interactions where characters just completely pour their heart and soul out because they're in such a bad place. And yeah, that's what I tried to kind of.
So let's talk a little bit about the journey, for want of another cliche, to get here for you, which was that, you know, going from the self-publishing from 18 to now 35 books, learning a lot along the way, clearly, to get to this point.
Yeah.
Why did you do that?
Yeah, so for anyone who doesn't know, my story is I've been reading since I was 4 and writing since I was 6, so it was something that I've just done forever. But by the time I was 18 and graduating high school, I'd already written a full-length novel that was like I don't know if anyone's read the Alex Rider series or bought that for their sons or anything. It's like the teen spy novels. So I'd written a book like that, and I graduated from school, started studying law, and thought, I'd just heard about self-publishing through Kindle, and I thought, let's give this a go. I'll take a gap year. This is probably the best opportunity that I have to do this. I'm still living at home. That wrote and published my first adult book, and that did well enough to be my full-time job. And so I haven't had another adult job basically, other than writing. So everyone's always shocked by this 30 books thing, but I think, you know, I've tried to be professional.
Now everyone else just feels like underachievers. That's
but from the first book I recognized that this is something that's self-publishing, and you know, people downloading it on the Kindle, that's something that no one's ever had the opportunity to do before, you know, the last 20 years. So I really didn't want to take it for granted. I really recognized how privileged I was to even just be able to write for a living. So I treated it like a full-time job. So I would show up and I would do my certain number of words for the day, and that led to kind of a book every 4 months roughly, and I just did that for 9 years. So that's what kind of leads to 30 books. And then I wrote the first 50 pages of this in, I think, 2021, just as a creative exercise to start a new series. And something about it was different, and I thought this is probably the best idea, like the best kind of story idea I've ever had. And so I didn't continue with that. I just sat on those 50 pages, and I thought, if I'm ever going to cross over to traditional publishing, it should be through this. So,
but you were doing, presumably you were making a reasonable living. Self-publishing.
I'm not that shy about it. I was doing well self-publishing, but I think there's a big difference. So, you know, 99% of my sales self-publishing were on the Kindle. And so that can be lucrative, but you're missing this entire side of things where, you know, before last week I'd never spoken in front of people. I'd never talked to an audience. I'd never met someone who'd read my book face to face and said, oh, I finished this in one day. I absolutely loved it. And I'd never had that happen before in like a 9-year career. So I think, yeah, there's like an impersonal side to self-publishing, I guess, which really sounds like first world problems. But
when you think about it, it's also been a great training ground, right? I've heard you talk about this before, but the first books that you wrote are clearly not as good as the ones towards the end.
Correct, and I'm upfront about that.
That's right. And a lot of the feedback you get from readers very quickly online, right?
Yeah, and so that was another side of things that was very interesting, and that, like, looking back on, I guess, the history of writing, like, I don't think writers have really ever had that opportunity where, when I was 18, I published a book and within 2 weeks I had feedback in the form of reviews being like, oh, this bit was great, but, you know, this character, you just forgot about them, or, you know, this dialogue, no one would ever speak that way. It was immediate feedback, and it's hard to deal with in some ways, because it's like, I was 18 and total strangers were, you know, some of them loved, most people really enjoyed it. Some people were like, this is the worst thing I've ever read in my life. That takes a little bit of an ego hit, but then, but you learn. And so each book I was learning so quickly, based on the criticism that was actually constructive. It was like, I see my self-publishing career as like the best creative writing degree I could have ever gotten. So if anyone here has kids who are writing, or, you know, anyone in their lives who are interested in writing, I would recommend if they're thinking of trying self-publishing, just to do it as like an experiment, and not to sort of attach all this weight to it as like the be all and end all. Like there is so much to learn from putting your work in front of strangers. And it's very hard. That's why, you know, that's,
you need to have a thick skin.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the other thing that you were doing was, we both are big fans of Don Winslow, but, you know, I might read Don Winslow and get a few ideas. You were actually transcribing it as you were reading it, right?
Yeah.
Which is an interesting way of sort of absorbing the techniques of someone like that.
Yeah, so probably about 5 years ago, I read an article about how Hunter S. Thompson, the journalist, he'd transcribed The Great Gatsby, which means that he'd just got the document up or the book up and he'd typed it out word for word just on his computer. So each sentence, he was reading it and he was typing what the sentence was. And he wrote the entire Great Gatsby out like that because he wanted to feel what it would be like to write prose that good. And so I read that article and I thought, oh, because so I just stumbled onto Don Winslow, who is my favorite crime writer of all time. I don't know if anyone's read anything by him, but his books are, you know, you'll see, if you read his and you read mine, you'll see some similarities, but they're very, very dark, but it's for an ultimately hopeful message. So I think if you go through the darkness, it almost makes the message at the end all that much more powerful. And that's what I found from Don's books. And so, yeah, so I typed out his books word for word, are the ones that I loved, because I couldn't understand how he was so good at what he was doing. Like
I think that should be part of any writing course, actually. It's such a great idea.
But feel free to prescribe it to anyone you know.
Because what you pick up at that pace when you're typing, it's slower and more deliberative than reading.
Yeah,
so and I'm picking up a lot more, I think. Yeah,
absolutely. And if something's really good, you know, if you're reading something you love, you do tend to kind of fly through it, because you're like, oh, this is, I can't put this down. Let's see what happens. And I think especially as a writer, like I would always miss a lot of the nuance that it's like, oh, why is this so good? But then I would skip over the parts that, or not skip over, but you know, read them very fast, the parts that made it as good as it was. And so
what did you learn from that, do you think?
So Don Winslow is, I think, the best in the world at knowing exactly what to include in his story and what not. Because I guess that's kind of the whole goal of a writer is how much do you describe and how much do you pull back from? Because sometimes Don doesn't describe all that much in a scene, and it's still the most powerful scene you've ever read. It's somehow it's just so.
One thing he does do, I think you're right, is he gives people, the reader, the ability to take the story themselves and to imagine more about what's actually happening than he's actually writing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And that is a great skill of fiction writers generally, but particularly people who are writing, you know, these sorts of books, the sort of books that we write.
Exactly. And I think he actually taught me through transcribing him to, you know, that cliche of like kill your darlings, like the things that you're writing that you love the most, like, and I would do the same thing. So I in my self-publishing career, I was sort of known for writing very good fight scenes, and I would go into a lot of detail, and because I would know about the sort of martial arts involved, and that was sort of my passion, so I would describe it in great detail. And then I just kind of took a step back and realized I've just spent like a page describing something that most people probably don't care about. Like it's, you know, it's interesting if it serves the story. You see it, I think you see it in a lot of like legal thrillers where it's almost like it's usually ex-lawyers who are trying to prove how much they know about law. And
to be honest, you see it a lot in books that journalists write as well, because
I've never seen it in a journalist.
Because their whole shtick is over-explaining things. But the fight scenes actually in this really are brilliant. I mean, you may have paired them back, but they do have an authenticity.
No, I've sort of cranked them up for this one, yeah.
have an authenticity about them that is obviously based in some knowledge. What is it? Where'd you get that from?
I've just always been – so I think that when action is done right, it can be like an art form in itself. So, I mean, Mad Max Fury Road is one of the greatest Australian – I think is one of the greatest Australian movies, and it is this just insane – 2-hour car chase, basically. But George Miller, who I love the fact that George Miller, if anyone knows that director, has directed the Happy Feet movies and the Mad Max movies. It's the most brilliant contrast. But yeah, I think that action can very easily be kind of shoehorned into a book just because people feel like their story needs some tense situations.
If it's starting to get boring, kill someone.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I can't talk because I kill a lot of people in this book. But yeah, I just think that's always kind of been my bread and butter. Like if anyone's read a Jack Reacher thriller, like the action in those books is very different. Like Lee Child is very, he has like a great intuition of like what is interesting to read about and what's interesting to write in terms of the actual, you know, people fighting or people, you know, having combat scenes. And so, yeah, I think I just I just try to take it really seriously in terms of like I don't just put it in mindlessly. And a lot of it serves to sort of show what the characters are going through. So Logan and Alice are both in some very violent scenes in this book. And I hope that after those scenes, you have a bit better understanding of their character. And because I think that can be what's, at least for me, that's what I love about thrillers, is that we learn about these characters through these very intense situations. So, you know, often it's in thrillers, people are, you know, they're fighting for their lives or things that you know, extreme situations are happening. And if we get to the end of that and you understand what makes them tick a little bit better and you can see how they were able to persevere through whatever they're going through.
There's a lot of persevering in this book.
Thank you. but yeah, that's kind of my mindset around it. I grew up watching action movies, loving action movies. I just try to do it.
And it is done really, really well. This book is also, it's set in America. Why, were all of your books that you published before this, you self-published, were they American books too?
They're all American characters because I started with, so I grew up, so probably the first adult books I read were the Jack Reacher series, and then I moved into Vince Flynn, and then that kind of led me to, say, Don Winslow, who's probably a little bit more of a literary writer than strictly commercial, and then into kind of noir, which is a bit more obscure, but like S.A. Cosby, Jordan Harper, these are kind of American noir authors, and I'm not sure why I gravitated towards that. I think America serves as like a very interesting playground for all of these ideas because in a way it is larger than life. There's a lot of ambition, there's a lot of corruption. It's like everything, the good and the bad are almost heightened in different ways as we're seeing at the moment. But yeah, I've always written American characters. My books, my self-published books are set all over the world. But yeah, I'm not really sure why. I just think, yeah, it's this, in a sense, it's this larger than life like arena to set these plots in, and I guess maybe that makes the action a bit more believable because it's this big American setting. But yeah, I think you know the corruption also can run deeper, and the corruption is kind of the heart of the plot of this book.
The Forsaken is just the first, obviously, of a series of books that are going to come with Logan. And the next one, I understand, is not set in America. It's set in Colombia, is that right?
Yeah, it's about half America, half Colombia. But yeah,
Have you been to Colombia?
No, not yet. I'm going. As like a research trip, because I'm like fine-tuning the sequel at the moment. But so my self-published books, I figured it out the other day. I've set my self-published books in about 30 different countries. And I've been to probably half of them, but I think the research is so important, obviously. But there's almost like new ways of research now that weren't ever accessible before. Like you can drop a Google pin street map
onto you can see the street.
You can walk through a neighborhood, an entire neighborhood, circling it block by block online. Yeah. Which is just such a crazy. Like I feel like people my age, especially, take that for granted because we haven't known anything else. And you know, I set a book in the jungles of Guatemala, one of my self-published books. The jungles of Guatemala. And I had an email from someone who had spent 10 years of his life as like a freedom fighter there and said, And I was like, oh, I'm so sorry. I haven't even been there. I feel like a fraud. And he said, no, you, I don't know what you did, but you nailed exactly the feeling of being there. So, yeah.
You know, that's the skill of a great writer is to, as I was saying before, give the reader the ability to imagine what's in front of them or what's in their own head.
Yeah. And I get
without actually sort of spelling it out.
Yeah, and I think that's why I'm obsessed with Don, because it's like he writes about Don Winslow's greatest work, I think, is the Cartel trilogy, which is about the war on drugs in Mexico and sort of the impact of that on everyone involved in it. And so they're these huge 800-page books, and they're just I couldn't believe how much he taps into the just kind of the human experience, like what everyone involved in that was going through. And, you know, he wasn't part of that. He interviewed people who were part of it. And he just that, I think that's what I try my very best to learn from, is the abilities of great writers to, know exactly what to include.
And have you thought about an Australian book?
Yes, I'd love to. As soon as a publisher asks me, I'm there. So this happened. The Forsaken came about probably almost 2 years ago now. Simon and Schuster signed it to a 3-book deal. So I'm focused on that at the moment. But yeah, I would love to do. I think there haven't been many sort of like gritty like thrillers in Australia set in a city. And I'd love that kind of urban intensity. I don't know. That's my next.
Talk to your publishers, see if they like it.
Yeah, float the idea.
Look, we're nearly ready for questions. We are ready for questions. If there are any out there, does anybody have a question? Yes, at the back there.
No problems.
You mentioned researching the locations, but I think something you do really well is having a deep understanding of human personality and character. So how do you get so good at it? Like, do you do a psychology course?
Thank you. So I studied philosophy in
high school.
Sorry?
No kidding.
Yeah, so yeah, if you get this, it's half philosophical, which you wouldn't think from a violent action thriller. But so I don't know if anyone's seen True Detective, the HBO show with Matthew McConaughey. So that is my favorite. That the first season of that is my favorite television season of all time. And it kind of showed me that you can include this heavier philosophy in something, and the audience really wants that, and they're really interested in like the depths of human nature, I guess. But yeah, to answer your question, I've always been obsessed with why we make the choices we do and why people do the things they do. And I think that has lent itself for me very well to fiction, because it doesn't matter. You know, when I'm writing a man or a woman, I'm not writing those specific things. I'm just writing like a human being. And I think that people have asked me, you know, how have you written Alice in this way? And I think that we're all kind of going through similar issues in all different various natures and different, I don't know, the different versions of the sort of the human condition. That started working itself more and more into my self-published books. So I started with these books that were, because I think when you're young and I was just imitating the books that I loved. Like, I was trying to write a Jack Reacher thriller. And so it was very basic, you know, good guy beats up bad guy. And then I slowly started including, I guess, more and more philosophy, and that expanded my characters. I've always been obsessed with philosophy, psychology, why we make the decisions we make, hope that answers it in some way.
Like, all the characters in this book are complex, but the villains are particularly complex. And the big villain, Datvian, is, terrific. Like, a good villain, a book, these books need good villains, and this is a good villain.
So there was one review that I saw that said, this was an amazing book. The villain was so bizarre that that was the only drawback, that it was just, I just couldn't wrap my head around him. And so I think if you get this book, I'll brief you now so that you sort of go into it with a bit of an understanding. But so Daniel Dartvian is a real estate billionaire in New York who's only about 30 years old, and he cannot slow down in any way. He has crippling social anxiety, and he thinks that his worth only comes from how much he achieves. So he's constantly trying to achieve more, 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 and he doesn't care who he has to hurt to get that done, because he's so deeply insecure with himself. And so he basically spends this entire book having like a nervous breakdown. And to everyone else, he is this menacing, terrifying figure. and to him, and I, then I do a few chapters from his point of view, and to himself, he's his own worst enemy, and he hates himself, and that's most of the reason why he keeps moving forward at this rate and hurting anyone. And so, yeah, that also, you know, a bit of philosophy ties into that. And I just wanted each character in this book to make people kind of stop and go, oh, that's odd. I haven't seen that, you know. I haven't seen like a terrifying crime boss with like very bad social anxiety. Yeah.
That's exactly. And it's very well drawn. Any other questions? Here's a question.
Yeah, you were saying that you sort of think cinematically when you were talking about doing the planning for your writing. Do you ever put have visual images that go along with the writing to kind of stimulate that journey?
Yeah, I think this, I don't know how common this is for writers, but at least for me, I grew up on these movies and TV shows that really did inspire me. And so I guess whenever I write, I see it like unspooling as like an actual scene in my head when I'm writing it. So fun fact, I wrote the main character in this Logan to resemble Chris Hemsworth because I was picturing Chris Hemsworth in my head the entire, because I think that he has acting chops and he just hasn't had the chance to show it yet.
Booth is his.
Yeah, hopefully if we all tag him, no. I often do see my characters as actors and actresses from shows that I've seen and loved. So Alice, I pictured Kaylee Spaney, who was Priscilla in the Priscilla film, and she's been in like the recent Alien movie. And then Daniel Darfy and the villain, I pictured Kieran Culkin. I don't know if anyone knows. Yeah, Macaulay Culkin's brother. Yeah, so he's from like Succession. But yeah, I wanted this kind of unhinged energy. I don't know if that's not a nice thing to say about Kieran. But I see the scene, and then that's why I transcribe all the time. That's why I try to really like improve my toolbox as a writer, because the scene is in my head, and if I have the biggest toolbox I can get it down on the page as accurately as I can. I think that's just always what I've tried to improve at over the years.
Anyone else? Here we go. Oh, over there.
Thank you. Your book sounds very interesting and intriguing.
Thank you.
But in your research, I was just wondering, how real are these CIA agents? How come they're so ineffective going right back to the Cuban Missile Crisis where they got that completely wrong?
Yeah.
They have no influence on Russia or China or North Korea or even Hamas. So they actually don't seem to be achieving anything.
We'll take that as a comment.
Yeah. So I don't want to spoil it, but I've written 30 vigilante thrillers, and I've grown up reading these kind of American CIA focused books, and I think a lot of the times they can gloss over some really terrible stuff that the CIA has done in the past. In the 80s especially, it was very, very bad. And one of the highlights of my career was that, so this, you know, this book, it's not anti-America, but Logan is against serving the US government. He doesn't want someone to tell him, you have to go here and kill that person because we say so. He wants to be the judgment on that. And so I sent this book to Kyle Mills. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of him, but he wrote 9 of the Mitch Rapp thrillers in Vince Flynn's series, which is about CIA agents and Kyle's an American guy. His dad was in the FBI. And after I sent it to him, I thought, oh, this could, he might not like this at all. But he sent back a lovely endorsement quote, and he really, really enjoyed the book. That was really important to me, is like pointing out where some areas in this book I sort of delve into the history of some pretty bad stuff the CIA did in Central America in the 80s, and to still get the approval of someone like Carl Mills was something that meant a lot to me, because I think that all this stuff is so nuanced, and I think especially people my generation can have this very black and white view on one way or the other. It's like who's evil and who's not. And I think the world can be so grey. And so that's what I try to do with my books, is like just make everyone in it human, as human as possible. And then, yeah, hopefully you, the reader takes something away from that. That's my goal. Yeah.
So actually I did think that the fight scenes went on a bit long, so I did skip that and just say that. But on the other hand, I do object to when I feel like people don't know what they're writing about when they say, oh, he or she, you know, blew up something. 2 minutes later, you know, they raced out of the building, they weren't hurt or whatever, you know, then they went and killed 50 guys and then, you know, they went and had a cup of coffee. So I thought the way that you explained the fights and you described what was going on was also a good balance. The other thing is that I did like the character depth. So, you know, another problem that I have is when, you know, particularly on Netflix, you know, there's a tidal wave coming, you know, and they've got, you know, 3 minutes and they're saying, oh, you know, can you look after my mum and, you know, feed the cat and put the bins out and, you know, blah, 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 and tell my sister I love her and all of that kind of thing. So I thought that the, you know, you achieved that balance really well where the characters are feeling and they have emotions, you know, Logan and Alice. And so I did also want to ask about the research that you did, because I thought that you described the, you know, the crack addiction and that scene really well. So I'm not suggesting, you know, that you became a crack addict, but I'm just wondering what kind, did you interview people or read about it?
Yeah, I won't go into too much detail here, but I've grown up around addiction. I've seen addiction in the flesh. I have tremendous empathy for people suffering from addiction, and that's a big part of this book. Alice is a drug addict in this book, and that's a big part. That's a big part of the core of this book. And I didn't want to put it in there with any kind of flippancy, like, oh, you know, that's just something that people include. I think that if there's a theme like that in a book, you have to take it very, very seriously, and you have to really have a lot of empathy for the characters involved. And so that is the kind of dichotomy I wanted to have between Logan and Alice. Like, he's Logan's addicted to alcohol this book as well, and which is, I guess, not as extreme an addiction, but it's still, you know, they're broken, they're both broken individuals. I do a ton of research on everything I put into a book, because I'm not a huge fan of when people put really intense themes into a book just for the sake of making it intense. Like, I think that's why this book is so dark, because I wanted to kind of have these themes in it and then also respect how dark that can get for these people. So, because, I mean, tying back to True Detective season one, you know, that has some of the darkest subject matter you can possibly think of, that season with Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. And then it ends on this ultimately hopeful message. And I think if you can get through the darkness and you can treat it with the respect that it deserves, then you can come to, you know, a really strong realizer, or, you know, a really strong ending for a book like this. So
I think this question, there's a question here at the front of, should be waiting for a while.
I was just going to ask whether you think Logan could philosophize around taking out a president, for example.
Taking out who?
A president.
A president, absolutely.
Yes.
But
no spoilers.
So, yeah, so I'm going to spoil it. I can't spoil it, but I've already written the sequel, and that is incredibly relevant. So,
There's plenty of politics in it as well.
I'll leave it at that. You'll with about 30 pages to go, if you read this, you'll get hit by something that you'll be like, oh, I'm glad I asked that question.
In America, who would have thought? Yes.
Thank you. I just have a question about your self-publishing journey. It seems that when you go with the publishing house, you've got a network of support behind you with editors and you name it all. How do you do it independently?
Yeah, so I had a kind of contrarian way that I approached this where I would have a copy editor for all of my self-published books, which is just kind of grammar and, you know, editing for spelling mistakes and that kind of thing. But when I was self-published, I never had a story editor because when I was self-published, I thought I could get five different story editors and they could have five different subjective opinions on the book about what would work and what wouldn't. And then it's like, well, who do I listen to? Do I listen to this person? Do I listen to this? And so then now that I'm with a traditional publisher, it's like they employ like a whole staff of experts who, you know, so it's a much more extensive editing process. So that was, I was ready for that and that was actually fine. I thought I would have a lot more problems with that than I actually did. So that was great just to like go back and forth on story suggestions and things like that. It was very, very different, a lot longer of a process. Like I wrote this 20 months ago and it's finally now out. And whereas when I was self-published, I'd get something edited and I'd just click upload and then it was done. So very different process, but a lot more rewarding, I found.
Anyone else?
We have time for one more question.
Well, given we're talking about the editing process and this, you're saying this one is more rewarding, what is it about the editing process, the traditional editing process that you've now been through that you find has helped you push these into some perhaps above where you were before?
Yeah, I think I'd never been pushed in regards to the story. Like I always kind of assumed that was my responsibility to, you know, the story was up to me. It still is, but the edits, there were no major plot changes. So I was very grateful for that. But like the first time you open the document and there's 1,000 suggestions from your editor, I called my agent, Dan, who's in the room, and I said, I think they hate this. I think they don't even want to publish this. And then he said, oh, look, sleep on it and, you know, wake up tomorrow and realize that these are all tiny little suggestions and tweaks. And, it was – now looking back on it, it's such a tighter and better manuscript for that reason that I went through that process.
One of the other things I think you're going to have to face, having done – been a self-publisher where you can do, as you say, write a book in 3 or 4 months – hit up, send, up you go, 3 books, 4 books a year. Publishers are going to be telling you slow down, aren't they? We don't want 3 books a year.
Yeah.
We want maybe one, possibly two if you're as good as Connolly. You know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll do as much as they want from me. But, I've finished writing the sequel to this. Don't know when that'll be out. I'm guessing a year from now. It's a 3-book deal with Simon & Schuster. So I started the third one and then I thought that's ridiculous. I don't need to do that yet. I'm not sure. I think I am still geared towards writing fast. And well, it's not so much fast. It's more like just the natural pace that I go at. Like I think a lot of people who heard my self-publishing story, they assumed that I was rushing these things out to sell as many books as possible. And I've always written at that speed. And if you kind of break it down, it's 1,000 words a day. Like it's not a crazy amount of actual writing, but because it was my job, I just made sure not to miss a day. I think I'm suited to that. So I think if whoever comes calling, I'll just keep writing as much as I can.
Right. Well, I think I will agree. It's a great story. Matt's story is a great story. The book is a fantastic book. I urge you to take advantage of the special offer of paying for 3 and getting 3. That's out, and my book is coming out in – this new book is coming out in 6 weeks, so get that one.
And Dust is fantastic. It is absolutely amazing. I've never done that before, so I don't have anything else to add. It's a great book.
Thank you very much for coming. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.